Marcia. Okay, good.
So we need the second.
This is class four, class six, 10th of Cheshvan, October 18th, 2010. So we're continuing. This is the third class, and we're going to finish up mitzvah number 95, but we said we're going to start a whole unit on the Beit HaMikdash. So I'll just tell you in my process. What I did was I first went through the index here that's in the first book of all 613 mitzvot and made...
Says what they really are.
It says what they, it just says the name of the mitzvah.
Right.
And it does not say the pasuk where it comes from, but it does say the parsha where it's in. So you have to look up each one to find the pasuk that it's in. Mm-hmm. But what I did is I went through it and I started making sections and dividing up. I know other people have done this, but to divide up the mitzvahs by subject rather than by chronological order, because the Sefer Chinuch goes by chronological order through the parshiot, and therefore they're not always related to each other when they're next to each other. They can be kind of all over the place depending on what the Torah has to say. So there's a reason for doing it in the order of the Torah. Of course, God had his reasons. But let's say we want to study all the mitzvahs of the Mikdash or all the mitzvahs of Kohanim or all the mitzvahs of Korbanot. We would have to look all through. So I started to group them. So I have them partially grouped now. And then I realized that I really should use somebody else's grouping. Why should I do all that myself?
Somebody really has gone to the other.
Somebody has done it, right? But I also felt like I should do it as my own exercise, that it's important to do it. But as I got to around mitzvah 200, 300, I started to realize that there's another 300 to go. And I probably should, and now at this point, use my time.
Use help.
Right, so I wanted the exercise of it, but I also don't have time for that full exercise. So just so you know, in case you care, on aish.com is a list of 613 mitzvot, grouped by category. Yes. It's like 22 pages long, something like that. So,
how do you find it?
Go on aish.com and type in 613 mitzvot. And it's a whole list of the 613. And that list is grouped by the order of, it's grouped by categories, or grouped specifically by the order of the Rambam in his Mishneh Torah. So the Mishneh Torah, as you know, is the Rambam's, in a way, rewriting of the Gemara into subject categories, because the Gemara also, the Talmud, is written scattered everywhere. So if anybody wanted to look up something, let's say you were interested in the laws of the temple, right? You wouldn't be able to look it up in the Gemara. You could look up chunks here and there, but it's scattered throughout. There's a sentence here, there's a story there, there's a longer piece here and there. But if you want it all grouped together, you will not find it all grouped together in the Gemara. Neither will you find all the laws of fasting or all the laws of tshuva or all the laws of, or all the interesting things about angels or demons or anything like you, or axes. It's not all in one place. Whereas it is all in one place in the Mishneh Torah. That's what the Rambam did. That was his Rambam.
With an
Rambam. So the way that you can tell the difference is Rambam, the accent, is on the first syllable. Ramban, the accent, is on the second syllable. So that's just how you can tell in conversation, because that is how it's pronounced. Rambam, Ramban.
But not everyone is so careful.
Yeah. That is the way it's said. Right, but that is what it's... Nobody says Ramban.
No, they don't.
It's not. Yeah. It's not Ramban. It's Ramban. It's not... Yeah, Rambam, Ramban, right? So that's Maimonides, Nachmanides. So the Rambam's magnum opus was the Mishneh Torah, and he wrote it so that you could find everything in its own section.
By subject matter.
By subject matter. So, and so that's it's called. It's also called the Yad HaChazaka. So Mishneh Torah is because it repeats the whole Torah, and in this case, the oral Torah. Mishnah means repetition of Mishneh Torah. So that's his magnum opus, and it's got 14 volumes, which is why it's also called the Yad HaChazaka, because Yad, Yod Dalad, is 14.
Oh, okay.
14 volumes. So it's also called the Yad HaChazaka. So there's 14 volumes.
It's printed in 14 volumes.
It's 14 volumes. So that's why when you find the 613 mitzvot on aish.com, you will see it's divided into 14 sections of the Rambam. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and in the Rambam, each section that he has is called a halacha, because it'll have chapters, and then each piece, instead of like, let's say if we were learning the Mishnah, each paragraph, numbered paragraph, would be called a Mishnah. In the Rambam, it's called a halacha, because the Rambam basically distilled it into halacha. He wasn't about process, he was about product. So whereas the Talmud is about process, it's about how you learn, how you train your mind to think in a Talmudic way, and also from that training then apply it and derive the halacha from the material, the Rambam was, look, we got to know what the halacha is here. So let's start listing them. And that's what he did. So it's not a process book. It's a product book. Want to know the halachas of Kriyas Shema? Open up the Rambam, Hilchot Kriyas Shema, and it will tell you. This is when you can tell the sun goes down. This is when you're supposed to read it. This is until when you can read it. This is how you have to say it. This is how much kavana you have to be yotzei it. This is like straight up, that's the halacha of it.
Do you own that 14 volumes?
I don't have the whole 14 volumes, no. I have a few of them. And I think I'll probably order another one for this. So that being said, as I thought to myself, well, gosh, I better order that volume of the Rambam and learn it. And not only that, I should get another book on the Beit HaMikdash in English that I could read, because I'm going to have to learn a lot about the Beit HaMikdash to give this section. Then I realized, wait a second, that's a little asking too much of me right now in this stage of my life. I'm not an expert. So that's all this introduction to say, I am not an expert in the temple, and nor will I become one over the course of the next few months or weeks, right? So I'm just going to bring you through the Sefer Chinuch, which is our Sefer, and I will, Be'ezrat Hashem, do enough extra learning to make sense of that. And I will bring diagrams. I have
a copy.
And here's, who has an extra? Is this an extra?
No.
No. Okay. So take this one for now. Right, take that one for now. So, because I did bring two extras for today. So, I do want to go through a little bit of the Beit HaMikdash, but we're going to start by finishing this halacha, which will bring us into the diagram a little bit. And then I assigned you extra credit, homework. I don't know if you need it. I don't think you need it.
And next week we need volumes.
So, if you want to follow inside next week, you will need volumes
1, 2, and 3.
Is it 1, 2, and 3?
Well, I don't know what.
Well, look.
Let's
look at your.
Oh yeah, she's got.
You have all five, so.
What's
so
two?
Can you,
well, 95 is this is.
Yeah. So volume one. But what's 254 in? Which volume is in 254? I mean, which? Yeah. Which volume is 254? You just look on the spine.
Oh.
This is 211.
Right, so okay, so you need three and.
Maybe four.
And 391 is in which? Four.
Four.
So you need three and four. So you need 1, 3, and 4 for next week. Which is why I put it on the bottom of the page.
Very good. Thank you.
So that you would be forewarned as to which volumes to bring next
now
week.
All we have to do is remember.
Right, if you want to see it inside. However, since I am working on, as I told you earlier in the year, on preparing better, I happen to have read all of them in advance. So I can tell you that you don't necessarily, if you forget it, it's not going to be a tragedy. Because not like this one, where you do need to see it inside.
Okay.
They're much shorter, and we can learn it from outside if you need to. But if you want to follow it from inside, bring it.
I have
right.
A book. I mean.
Right. So, yeah, if you have it, great. And, I mean, if you bring it, great. And if not, not. Okay, with that whole long introduction, and let me just point out the extra credit homework in case anybody leaves before I get to it. So the extra credit homework, which you will get gold stars for.
And she's bringing it.
Is to take out your Derech Hashem, for those of you who learned it with me. And even for those of you who didn't, it will be an extra research project. You'll get 2 gold stars if you find it. the place in Derech Hashem that talks about the sections of the Mikdash as they relate to the sections of prayer and the Tetragrammaton, which is the 4-letter name of God. That's the fancy English word for the Yod-Kei-Vav-Kei name of God. So there is a section, I'll just give you a hint, it's in the end of Derech Hashem. Okay. So look around there to find where it talks about Tefillah, Beit HaMikdash, name of Hashem. And hopefully we'll go into that either next time or the time after. But that's an interesting study, so if you get a chance to do that homework, that would be lovely. If not, Derech Hashem is a book, The Way of God. And when, if you don't have it on your shelf, so don't worry about it. But you just won't get the gold star. That's all.
Which we studied for 2 or 3 years.
We did study. I think 4 years. It took
four
us 4 years.
Years
to go through the whole thing.
It was a long time, I know.
We did spend 4 years. We went cover to cover through the whole thing. So, yeah. Okay. So I think we were up to... did we get to the difference between man and animal?
Well,
what do you have?
I have the bottom, the last paragraph of 363 is where we stopped, but I'm pretty sure that's right, but that's where I stopped making notes anyway.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Good.
Not as far as you thought.
That's okay. We're going to go a little fast. Okay, so we talked about then, we ended off with talking about why korbanot and how they work and the fact that
right.
we do want to give something that's an object of desire, but it has nothing to do with bribing God or trying to get into God's good graces or that God needs anything from us at all. It's all about
right.
from our side. It's a physical exercise to lead to spiritual results. And that we should come to feel differently because of what we see and how we participate in it. So we talked about what a korban is, and that now there's another aspect to it. So the difference between man and beast. So I think this is, I mean, there's so much philosophy in this mitzvah. It's a fabulous one, everything that he writes. So I'll read this inside because it's interesting to see how he writes it. So the bottom, the last paragraph on 363. There is yet another way in which the heart is bestirred by an animal offering. Through the similarity, since the bodies of man and animal resemble one another in all their features, being differentiated only by the fact that intelligence was given the one and not the other. So it's interesting to think about how, I mean, today certainly we talk about how humans are animals, we're just different animals, and there is certainly debate today as to their value. Are they more valuable than animals or are they not? I mean, that's not probably the debate in this room. However, everybody's heard that type of debate, that who are we to think that we're the top of the food chain or the top of the scale or the top of the anything? Rabbi Tatz says that that is the challenge of this generation, is to understand the difference between man and animal, and that that challenge in the larger populace is based in the internal Jewish challenge. It's a reflection of the internal Jewish challenge of trying to understand the difference between Jew and non-Jew. Because we Jews hold that the hierarchy, and it is a hierarchy, is inanimate and then animate. So animate's divided into plants, animals, humans, Jews. That's how we see it. So, pardon? So we have a more developed aspect to us. It's all about development, right? So plants are alive and possibly even slightly sentient. That's not really necessarily the discussion, but there's no volition. So in terms of volition, in terms of free will, in terms of ability to be masters of their own lives and connect with Hashem in the deepest way, that's the levels. So a plant can receive but can't do much giving and certainly can't move or do anything by its own volition, even if it might be slightly sentient. Whereas an animal can move. An animal is really a plant, except for it moves, right? Because it has instinct, but it doesn't necessarily have free will, it doesn't have intellectual thought, it doesn't have ability to think of it or self-awareness, even though there are some animals with some self-awareness. Elephants apparently have self-awareness, and I don't know if dogs do or not, but whatever. But that's not necessarily the definition. They clearly don't have
They clearly
don't have moral free will. There's no moral sensibility in the animal kingdom. Even if there is instinctual caring for another, caring pods of whales, care for the young so mom whales can sleep, etc. Elephants take care of their elderly and infirm. But so even if there is what to us might look like a moral conscience, it's not moral. It's just instinct. So really an animal, according to Rav Hirsch, is a moving plant in that a plant takes in and puts out, and so does an animal take in sustenance and puts out waste, and it's just the main difference is that one can move and one cannot. One is rooted and one is not. So then comes human beings speaking. So in it's not called human, actually, in the Jewish hierarchy, it's called medaber, is the category of all humans, medaber. And that is the distinguishing trait, is that we speak. We have words. And even if there are other animals that have some type of ability to communicate, bumblebees, you know, can tell each other where things are, whatever it is, they don't speak. Nobody has language like we have language. Nobody communicates to the extent that we communicate. Right? And nobody has just words that create relationships with each other or creates shalom and distance like our language does. Our language is clearly different than, categorically different than that of any other species. So that's medaber. So, and that distinguishes this group within the kingdom of living things from the other groups. And then further distinguished is a subset is the Jews. So the Jews have a different soul and are able to have a different level of free will, and hopefully a finer sense of responsibility and requirement, and in a way privilege. And I know as Americans it's hard to swallow that, but that's the truth. That's what the Torah says. We are chosen by Hashem for a finer mission. Our job is to lead all humanity, not to leave any human beings behind. Our job is to be the priests of the entire world. So to minister to all human beings and help bring all human beings into relationship with God to the extent that each human being can be in that relationship. And we have to lead the way through our greater level of responsibility. So that's our job. So all that being said, then, the similarity between the bodies of man and the bodies of animals. So do animals really look like us? Well, not really, and yet yes. They have faces, and their faces look like ours, right? We don't identify with plants. When we chop down a plant, you know, we don't see eyes crying or hear a bleat or see ears that can hear. And there's no snuggliness in a plant. A plant never brushes up against you and says, I love you, or is concerned, or tattletales. I mean, Snowball, the smart dog, gets out a lot because he knows how to do that. And the other dogs are not as smart and not as skinny. They can't even follow him. But they come and tattle. That's how they have a special bark right away. I mean, there's a bark of there's somebody at the door, come to the door and answer it. There's a bark that Snowball is out and it's just not fair and we're inside. So there is a similarity. They have their stories to tell. They have their facial expressions and there's communication. Right. So and there is a feeling that a human being has even upon seeing a bird be slaughtered, but much more an animal be slaughtered. Because an animal is warm and is furry and is...
has a beating heart.
Yeah, has a relationship. There is a relationship and has a face with expression. So it's saying that the other way that the heart is bestirred by an animal offering is through the similarity. We see them like us and it should bring home the difference between us and them. And the difference is we are sentient. We are thinking, we have intellect and they do not. And if we choose not to use our intellect, we also have instinct. If we choose to live by instinct and not to override our instinct with intellect, if we choose to not exercise our humanity, which is our ability to override our instinct, that's really one of the definitions of humanity. You know, we could say, my instinct is whatever, but if we override that, that's human. Animals cannot override their instinct. Right? If an animal's hungry and sees a weak link somewhere, they're going to pounce on it and eat it. It's never going to say, I bet that mouse is really nursing its young, and so I'm not going to kill it now. I'll wait until the young are independent. Right? It's never going to say that. It's going to say, yum, mouse, snatch. Right? So it can't override its instinct, but we can. So that's one of the definitions of being human, is the ability to override our instinct. If we give that up and sin by just following our instinct, boy, that looks yummy. Boy, that person looks attractive. Boy, that conversation sounds great. I want to hear it, right? And we just go by instinct, then we have brought ourselves down to the level of animal. And so now we see the animal being offered, and we say, there's nothing between that and me, the way that I behaved. Nothing. I'm just like that that's being offered. The similarity is 100% because I've left my realm of humanity by engaging what I engaged in. And so we need to see that right there, that where there's nothing that distinguishes that and me except for my choice to be distinguished. If I give up that choice, right? If I choose not to distinguish myself, then I am the same. So that's the, good morning. That is the, nobody should think that Ty is not respectful of the time. She has to drop off her son first. So that's why she has to come late. Okay, just wanted to make sure that everybody knows that she does her best to get here on time. You're welcome whenever you come. So that's what he's saying here, is that that is the difference between animals and humans, is only the ability to engage in that process of reflection, of overriding instinct, of using our intellect to gain knowledge and to apply that knowledge to how we should live. That's uniquely human. So it says when the animal is burnt, it should be burnt to that animal then. Well, let's just read, because the way he writes it is really beautiful. So let's see. Now, the physical man leaves the boundary of intelligence at the time of sin. He ought to know then that he enters the boundary of the animals, as this alone sets them apart. For this reason, he was commanded to take a body of flesh like himself and bring it to the site chosen for the ennobling. I'm on page 365 at the top. Bring it to the site chosen for the ennobling exaltation of the intelligence. And there he is to burn it, to eradicate its memory. It is burnt completely. It shall not come to mind or be remembered in Jeremiah 3:16, in place of his body. This in order to form a strong conception in his heart that the entire business of a body without intelligence must perish and become completely void.
So would that mean, although it's sort of a different twist on it, that basically the idea of not eating meat, for example, would be an un-Jewish idea?
Well, it is an un-Jewish idea at this point. Even though the world was initially created with Adam and Eve and their descendants through Noah, until after the flood, they were vegetarians, or commanded to be vegetarians. That was the best state to be in. It's only from Noah that we were able to eat meat. And part of that is to specifically to eat it to say, I'm on top of this and I can consume this. I can transform the life force in this into a higher level where I will sanctify
it. By using it for myself.
Right, by using it for myself to do mitzvahs, to take this life force, which can't do a mitzvah, and translate it through me, which can, I thereby elevate this life. And there are Hasidic stories, whether they're true or not, but they say something about it. Where there's one of the Rebbe who goes fishing, and he just says, you know, Reb fish, and he jumps into the boat. Because that fish wants to be gefilte fish for Shabbos. Because it will be elevated through the eating on Shabbos and transforming into mitzvahs, the energy. And so we can elevate the animal kingdom by eating it that way, and we can bring it actually lower. Because an animal walking around just doing its, following its instinct, is doing what it's supposed to be doing. It can be brought higher by being brought into a human being who's going to do mitzvahs, but it can be brought lower by being brought into a human being who's going to do averas. So the animal is transformed by being consumed and then the energy being used in one way or the other. We'll bring it higher than it could be or lower than it could be on its own.
And why do you want to eradicate its memory completely?
So what we want to eradicate is not the memory of the animal, but the concept of a body without intelligence. So this has to do with, and I'm very sorry to say to everybody who loves their pets, the fact that animals don't go to heaven. There is no such thing as a doggy heaven. After our dog, Honey, was killed in a car accident and took a little while for her to die, so she was at the vet, and so the vet sent us a card after that. Oh, my gosh, it was very sad. So the card was all about the Rainbow Bridge. And how the animal, the dog, had crossed the rainbow bridge, and how it was frolicking in the fields and
like,
waiting,
I don't think so.
And waiting for its owner.
And what's the bill?
After 120 years, that the owner will come, and finally, when the owner crosses the rainbow bridge, that dog is going to scamper up to its owner and nuzzle its little face, and they'll be together again in the field on the other side of the rainbow bridge. Oh my God, even though I didn't believe that, I was crying and crying.
Sounded so
totally. We're going to see Honey again.
It's really hard when the cat dies.
It is really hard. So, but the truth is, animals are called behemot, behema, ba, ma. In it is what it is. There's no extra. What you see is what you get. It's four legs, a face, a tail, a stomach, a mouth, what comes out to, that's what it is. That's all it is. It has a life force. It has a personality, but when it doesn't have a soul. So when it dies, it's dead. It doesn't have the human component. And so that's what has to be eradicated, is the thought inside of us that there is any value at all to a living being that doesn't have an eternity, that doesn't have a goal. So the animal's goal in life is to serve humans. The whole planet is to serve the human goal of connection with the divine. So everything is about that. So that doesn't mean that we can freely destroy whatever we want. That's our job too. We have to steward this planet. We have to guide it. We have to protect the resources. We have to use it. But we don't protect the resources to protect the resources, because God's in charge of everything. Global warming or not, like, I'm totally not scared of global warming. Hashem is completely in charge of the temperature of this planet. But still, it's my job to behave responsibly as my generation understands what responsible is. Right? So I could say, well, 100 years ago, Jews didn't recycle. Well, they totally didn't understand, and the planet was different. So you can't go by, 100 years ago, Jews smoked cigarettes. Oh, but they totally didn't understand the problems with that either. So as our generation understands what's responsible, I am responsible as a person in my own spiritual exercise as manifested in my physical activity to behave responsibly. But that is using the planet for my spiritual goal to connect to God. So I recycle to connect to God. So when I recycle, what I'm saying is I'm not taking lightly the gifts that you gave me. I appreciate them. And I hope that they can be recycled in a way that will be beneficial to the planet. It's a spiritual exercise. So, and the whole planet is for that. So we are allowed to use animals for, not for mean, you can't do dog fights, that's not okay. But you could test a drug on an animal, that's okay. You shouldn't make them suffer. I worked at Hadassah Hospital for a while, back in the day when I wanted to go to med school, and I was trying to get my name on a paper so I could get considered by the Israeli med schools. So I worked with a bunch of doctors doing experiments on mice, and I injected a lot of mice with a lot of drugs and a lot of antidotes to see how much of an overdose could they get before they were unrescuable by the antidote, right? So I'd OD them at different levels and rescue them at different levels and see who lived and who died. But whoever lived, they were going to get killed anyway because they'd already been experimented on. You can't use them again, right? But they still got fed and water. Like the ones who survived the experiment would be put in a cage with food and water until they were going to be killed. Because, why should you torture them? Yeah. Like, you know, right. So you're wasting food, really, and you're wasting water, except for you're not. Because you're treating animals humanely.
Right?
So yes, that you're permitted to use them to understand how to rescue a drug overdose patient when they show up in the emergency room and to know how much to give them based on what they got. Yes, you can do that. We are permitted to use animals to serve humans, but you still have to treat them as nicely as you can in that process. So that's what all this is saying, right? That a body of flesh alone is not intrinsically valuable except to the extent that it serves the connection of human beings and God. All human beings, not just Jews. So that's what we want to have perish and become void, is the idea, through burning that animal, the idea that a non-intelligent being, if we are one, is valuable. It's not valuable. We're not valuable as non-intelligent beings. We are only valuable to the extent that we employ whatever level. I'm not saying an unintelligent human being is not less valuable than a more intelligent. I'm just saying we all have human intelligence. We all have to use what we have. That's what makes us human. So, and if we don't, then we're like an animal. Okay. So let's see. So that should cause us, again, it's not that that life is offered instead of ours, although it says that. What it means is that life is offered to get us to get it. The whole point is that we should see it being burned. It should be a physical thing that drives into our minds and hearts that we actually deserve to die for what we did, and we are spared from that death. We have an extra chance. It's not because the animal died that we're spared from death. It's because we went through the experience and hopefully gained insight through that, and God is now just stretching out the time period between what we did and the punishment that we'll get so that we have a chance to do tshuva. We have a chance to correct our ways so that we won't hopefully have to face that at all. So it's not that the animal at all takes away from what we did. It's that the physical exercise of bringing the animal as an offering helps us realize, serves us, helps us realize that we deserve that, but we're not going to get that yet. So we learned when we were learning Tamar Devorah, I think it's the second one, it's pretty scary, that just to remind you of that scary stuff that we learned. Whenever we do something, we create a malach, right? I'm sure you've heard that. Whenever you do a mitzvah, you create a malach. Turns out, when you do the opposite of a mitzvah, you create a very negative malach. You still create a malach. You still create an angelic force, a spiritual force. There still is a spiritual creature that's created by everything that you do. So, the way it's explained to children is you create malachim that are healthy malachim and maybe injured malachim. Let's say you said Shema, that's a mitzvah, but you didn't have kavana. Right? So that malach has a broken leg. Right? So he can't run to defend you, but he's still there to defend you. Right? So, okay, that's a way to understand it. Of course, malachim are not walking around with legs, right? And they don't have a physical form at all, actually. So it's a way to think about it, that you've created a diminished malach. But the opposite is true, too, that when you do something negative, you create a negative spiritual force. So what we learned in Talmud Devarah is that negative spiritual force requires sustenance. And the sustenance that it requires is the life energy. And the place that it turns to receive that life energy is to its creator, us. And the only life energy that we have to offer it is our own. And so if it would turn to us and say, feed me, and we fed it, we would die. Because all we have is our life energy to give to it. So Hashem, this is the concept in Talmud Devarah of Nosei Avon, carries the sin. Hashem carries that sin for us, that physical force, that spiritual force that we created that requires sustenance. Hashem, even though Hashem is not required to at all, Hashem will feed it so that it can't kill us, so that it can stretch out the time between behavior and consequence. Because in that time between behavior and consequence is the space for tshuva. So Hashem will stretch out that time to allow us to do tshuva. Otherwise, if the results were instant, we would die right away. We wouldn't be able to have a chance for tshuva. So he has to stretch that time out. It's just like lahavdil, like if you eat a piece of cake, you don't get fat right away, right? So which allows you to eat it, because you want to be thin, but you want the cake. And you know if you eat the cake, you're not going to get fat that minute, right? So it's very easy to think, whatever, it's just one piece, I'll take a walk, but if you'd see the results right away, you wouldn't. So here with the results, and so that exists in our world, that we have the consequences and the behavior is distant one from another.
So when you do the teshuva in the meantime...
Then you kill it.
You kill that life force.
Mm-hmm. The negative one.
Yeah, the negative one.
You still get a consequence.
Pardon?
You still get a consequence.
Not necessarily.
Yes.
Not necessarily. And you can do teshuva from a positive thing, too, and kill that life force.
Really?
Yeah. So let's say you were very kind to somebody, right? Really reached out to them. You opened your home. They lived with you for a month. They ate your food. They gave you nothing, right? And then, let's say that happens.
Sorry.
I'm not mentioning anybody in particular. There's plenty of people in this room who've done that kind of thing. Whether it's a week, a month, a year, a weekend, whatever it is, right? You reached out to somebody, gave them, and you did it with a whole heart. And then later on, they weren't nice to you. They said something mean about you. They told somebody else you're a bad cook, and anyway, you don't give enough, you know? And you feel like, I never should have done that. Never. Never should have had them in my house. Oh, you just killed. You did tshuva from the good thing that you did. You regretted
it. Think about that.
Right? You regretted what you did, and you would take back the action if you could. That's doing tshuva.
Huh.
Right? So if you do tshuva, right?
That's the funny thing.
You could destroy them, the positive energy that you created.
You tshuva from regretting what you did.
I mean, can you end your life? I didn't mean to think that. It just popped into my head.
That's the whole story with Abraham and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Yetzer Hara wanting to get Abraham to regret the Akedah.
Right.
That's why Sarah died. He got...
Right, to get him to feel bad about it.
Regret the fact that he
then he wouldn't get the mitzvah from it.
Yitzchak, he wouldn't get credit for it.
Right, exactly. That's doing tshuva on the good. Exactly, so we have to be careful about that too. Right, so, yeah.
I think we just shouldn't get out of bed in the morning.
You've got to turn off your brain, though. Everything you think
it's a lot.
Matters.
It's a lot. So that, right. So, and that's why, that just ties into why we do say Jew is above Medaber, because who gets this? Even most Jews don't get this. How everything that you do makes a difference.
But wait
everything.
A minute. Well, wait a minute. I just had a thought. As soon as you said that, everything we think has...
That'd be a good one.
Well, no. We've talked before about the fact that Judaism is different than, for example, Catholicism, whereas if you think it, you've done it. You know, that whole thing about...
Jimmy Carter, lust in your
heart. Right, that whole thing. That doesn't count. But what we've just said is sort of the opposite of that, because what we've just said is what you think does count. In other words, you didn't undo the good thing you did. You didn't undo it. You just sort of thought, gee, really, was that the thing I should have done, be so nice to that person?
Well, so if you're just thinking it that way, that's different than really doing tshuva, like really feeling deep inside that you never should have done that, and you would absolutely do it differently if you could.
So if you really lust?
So, no, so that's different because you didn't do it yet. Although you're not supposed to really lust.
No,
right?
I understand.
Because we said before, I quoted Rabbi Shragi Friedman, had such a great quote, said, you can't prevent a bird from flying over your head, but you can prevent him from making a nest in your hair. Right? So I think it's a great thing to say, right? You can't prevent a thought of, whoa, he's hot, from coming into your mind when you see somebody. You can't prevent that. You think that, right? But you certainly can prevent the fantasy of what could come after that. Right. No nest should be made there, right? And that's up to you, right? That's right, get a grip. That's right. So you're not punished for that thought coming in. However, that being said, there is a slight punishment for that, because why were you looking? Did you have any right to be looking? Should you have been in that place? Should you have been on the beach watching a volleyball game of co-eds? Was that your business, right?
So,
right, as a Jew. So, right, was that your business? Should you have seen him with his shirt off? No, you shouldn't have, right? And that was your business that you put yourself in that position. So for that, you are punished, in a sense. Like, and same as, like, let's say a teenage boy. So if he has problems at night with nocturnal emissions, so is it really his fault? It's not. And yet, he was thinking about something during the day that he shouldn't have been thinking about, and that's why that happened. So he does have to control his thoughts. There is a level, it's not a level of volitional sin, but there is a level of culpability because of how you train your mind while you're awake.
So, if you really do lust in your mind, I mean, not just a passing thought of, gee, he's hot.
That's a problem.
But if you really do, it's not the same as actually doing it.
Correct. It's a different
Avera.
But it is an Avera. Yes. That's correct. That is correct. So, yes, right. No, it is. And the same thing, the converse, too. You really want to do something nice, and you couldn't. You get credit for that, right? You were on your way to the store to buy medicine for your friend next door who's sick. And there was a complete, this happens on the west side, probably not on the east side, there's a whole police blockade because they're looking for a fugitive.
And you couldn't get to the store.
And you couldn't get to the store. But you're in your car waiting, right?
So you get credit for that.
You get credit for it.
I haven't ever had that happen. You're right.
Don't be sitting there thinking lustful thoughts.
About the policeman who's looking for the bad guy, right?
Right.
So of that way, you're in this spot for a good reason. There you go. How about that?
Right.
This can be very complicated.
It could be very complicated.
It is very complicated.
It is. So that's the idea. And that is why Yehudi is on top of Medaber, because it is so complicated and because we know it. We have texts to teach us that. We have a Masorah that teaches us that. So, a Masorah, a tradition. So, people who don't engage in that learning, so they're not able to bring themselves up to that level. They might be stuck in the Medaber level, in this level of the speaker, and they might even be stuck in the Behema level, you know, where they're just a moving plant, where all they do is consume. You know, as I drove past Bronco, Mile High Stadium, Invesco Field yesterday. And I see all these people in orange, and I see, like, everybody's leaving the game, and I see, like, you know, they're walking down. It looked like an escalator, because you could see inside the ramps of people walking down. People are just moving. I've never been in there, so I don't know if it's a moving sidewalk or not, but that's what it looked like. I was like, oh my gosh, look how many people are wasting so much time and money on what?
On what?
I was there.
He had a lunch.
I did have a lunch.
I'm sure you did it, L'shem Shemayim. So, So
I did, because I have to do it because it's a Duke's thing.
So okay.
I did. Indeed.
So that's Michelle and Bud. That's the same Shemaim, right? So, but as I was driving past, I was in the car with Yehoshua, and he said, oh, Yehoshua said, Rabbi Avigdor Miller said, we should thank God for sports.
Why? Okay.
Because it keeps the masses busy.
There we go. I think that's
better than a pogrom.
I think that's probably a very good point.
Yeah, it keeps right. It keeps them busy. It keeps them.
It
keeps
their minds off the Jews anyway.
Exactly. That's what he said. Like, so it gives them a place to focus their testosterone,
exactly.
their high energy, and get their and their aggression, and they can focus it there, and they don't have to point it towards us. Right. Right. So we should be very thankful for that. So on the one hand, we can be thankful for that, but then on the other hand, you have to think about the person who is whose life is that, and there are people whose lives are that. Who are they really? You know, really, if their life is that. And I'm not saying a person who has that as part of their life, but there are people whose life is that. That's really a behemoth. It's not a medaber. That's really somebody who has abandoned their intellect and is just acting on instinct. They like to drink beer, they like to go to a game, they like to rah, 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 and they like to wear the... So they're going to earn money for the sake of being able to buy the ticket, buy the shirt, and buy the beer. But they're not... I mean, so I'm not saying every single person at all. I don't want to, you know, besmirch all sports watchers. There's definitely a place for that. But I'm saying for a person who's lost in that, and there are people who are lost in that, they have lost a part of their humanity or part of access to their humanity through that exercise. So so that's where there's just different levels of being a human being, and we can all strive to the highest level. It's not cut off from anybody, but it does require our individual choice. Each and every one of us is, each and every one of us has the ability to make the choice to choose ourselves into the highest level. So, okay. That's why we burn an animal, so that we should know that. Okay.
We're not making a lot of progress.
No, we're not. But we're going to. Okay. Now, let's just talk about, let's go to page 367. Let's talk about the goat. That goat that's sent to Azazel. This is an interesting offering, because it's an offering that's made outside of the sanctuary. So one is offered inside and one is offered outside, right? So you have the two goats on Yom Kippur. The laying on the hands, the sins on the two goats, one is sent off to Azazel and one is offered in the sanctuary. What is this outside of the sanctuary offering? I think this is a fascinating thing to consider. So if somebody sins, excuse me, they know there's tshuva possible. They know that if they wait, they know that over time they'll be forgiven. And so that's the goat that's burned in the sanctuary. It's in the sanctuary. And even though it's reduced to ashes, the ashes are in the sanctuary, in the space of God and God connection. Not like the goat that's sent off the cliff.
Is Azazel the one that goes off the cliff?
Yeah, Azazel, right.
Now that's the one wearing the string around his neck, right? Azazel? String turns white.
I think the string is in the Beit HaMikdash. It's not wearing it around its neck. I think.
But it's there for anybody can see it. I mean,
in the Beit HaMikdash, right? I think, right. Right. But I think this is interesting to think about. So the goat goes off the cliff. so look down after footnote 17 and two-thirds down the paragraph on page 367. To give them an analogy for the utter, total sinner, that even so will he perish swiftly and be utterly, totally destroyed, that they might learn and take heed of this and improve their ways. This is good augury for them. For none but a good friend teaches moral lessons. So that's interesting, right? So this is good to know. But so he's sent off. So we need more in this paragraph, but I'm not going to find that sentence. So we'll just think about it outside. He is thrown off the cliff to say, if you've totally sinned, if you've completely blown it, if you're that far, there is no place for you in the sanctuary, not even as ashes. Out you go. Often to the remote place where you're going to die alone, not even as part of a ceremony, not even as part of an elevation process, but just gone, just dead, with no ceremony, pushed off a cliff. You don't even get shechted. Off you go to drop and die by yourself. So that goat. So, and that is how that perishes. So that is to teach us to desire to be inside the sanctuary rather than outside the sanctuary. so that we have an opportunity. Right, it is severe.
So you
it's
have
who
a
goes.
Chance to basically do tshuva.
Right.
Because if you're outside the sanctuary, obviously that's the end.
Well, so just that goat is a mushel for it.
Right,
we have to understand
right,
that. It's not for any individual person that might go off a cliff.
No.
Should understand that. This is just a mushel for what this goat teaches, is that that goat goes off the cliff alone, not as part of the sanctified ceremony of what's going on in the Beit HaMikdash, that it's a mushel. It is a parable that teaches that goat is dying alone and not even as part of a sanctuary, and even its ashes, there won't be ashes. They're not in the sanctuary. There is no time. There is no space for that goat to be part of it. So those sinners that are attached to that goat as a mushel, that's how they'll perish.
They probably will not ever do teshuva.
That there is no tshuva. That they've gone to a place where there isn't tshuva. Can Hitler do tshuva? He can't. You can't do tshuva for that. But it's not just Hitler. There's a line before Hitler where you can't do tshuva from. Somewhere between me and Hitler, there is a line where past that line you can't do tshuva. You've done too much that you can't rectify it. That, on the other side of that line, is the goat to Azazel, whoever that is. And so that's what the goat represents, is those people who are unredeemable. They can't fix themselves. And so they will perish like that, totally, with no hope. So, and there are, unfortunately, Jews who will perish like that. So, and those Jews who perish like that, it's not just, so you know, because you might think, well, that's, you know, so how bad is it for Hitler? Just the lights go out, he's done, right? That's not what it is. It's a very, very long process of soul destruction, which is incredibly painful until it's all been paid. It is, because there is justice. So justice is meted out first. After he's paid for all the pain that he caused, and throughout all the generations, all the pain that he caused. I mean, I still see today, in the fourth generation, some grandchildren with irrational fears, great-grandchildren of survivors with irrational fears or problems in parent-child relationships that are from that. He has to pay for all that, right? All that. When he's paid for all that, that's when the lights go out. But first, all that has to be paid. So there's a lot of payment to make first. Okay, so now we can get down to the... Quickly, we have to just... Oh, my gosh. Okay. We'll get to parts of the Beit HaMikdash next time, but at least we'll get up to that, because that's the end of this. Okay, so as for the details of the difference in the different offerings, this paragraph, the second paragraph on the page, really talks about how we can understand little bits and pieces, like, for instance... somebody who speaks Lashon Hara has to bring a bird offering because birds chatter and his sin was chatter, right? Or different things like that. But it says basically that while that allows us slight insight into it, we basically can't understand a thing without the Kabbalists. That this is all Kabbalistic deep material, all the offerings. And we have no hope of understanding even really a drop of it without their assistance. And that's what he says. The sum of the matter is that even in the plain meanings, we cannot move hand or foot without help from the masters of the mystic tradition. To them, we must bow face down, and they will open our eyes with insight on all these points. So we just have to know it's extremely deep. Even that which we get a little bit, it's not even the tip of the iceberg. It's the speck of the tip of the iceberg. That's what's available to us. And the rest is... the Kabbalists have to tell us. It's not something that can be discerned logically. Unlike many other things, which can be discerned logically if you work on it, right? Because if Torah is the blueprint of the world, then a spiritually astute person, just like an architect should be able to discern a blueprint from a building, a spiritually astute person should be able to discern Torah from contemplating the world, right? That's everything except Kabbalah, which you can't get from discernment. That has to be given. So that's what these korbanot are. We could get a speck on our own, but it really is in the realm of Kabbalah to understand it all. So all we get is little bits of understanding, and that's what...
Kabbalists don't pass it on to the general population.
No, they don't. No, it's interesting to...
It's to remain hidden from...
Basically, it's to remain hidden, right. So, right. It's not taught. If you ever think you're going to a Kabbalah class, you could know for sure that it's not. Because it can't be taught that way, and it never would be taught that way, and anybody who really knows it wouldn't ever teach it that way. So if somebody's teaching it that way, you know for sure they don't know it. You could get specs, right? You can only get specs. And the way the deeper secrets are taught, so it could be taught one-on-one. Some of it could be taught one-on-one. But really, the way it's taught in the end, the deepest secrets, is not taught. It's only directed. So it's interesting to see. And I'm not
from God.
No. So there is some kind of, there are some instructions by Malachim, dreams, understandings, meditations, and things like that that one can get to on their own. But even the textual stuff, it has to be learned on one's own. And whatever they can get out of it, they can get, according to how they've developed themselves. So according to the level of understanding that one has and the spiritual work that one's done on oneself to create themselves into a vessel that can receive the information that's on the page, that's how much they can absorb when they read those sentences. So that's called hamevin yavin, right? The one who understands will understand.
But isn't that true? I mean, we've said that that's true about virtually all
almost everything, right, for sure. But Kabbalah is different because Kabbalah can't be explained this way. Right, so for sure, Hamivin Yavin, everybody in this room understands something slightly different from what I'm explaining because of your own experience in life. You get different things out of it. That's for sure true. But this is different because let's say I understood anything about Kabbalah and felt that I shouldn't explain it to you, that one thing, because of who you are, where the level that you're on. If I was on such a level, but I felt that you might have access to a drop of it, then I would say that's a great question. You could find some information about that here, and I would give you the source if I knew it, which I don't. So,
and then
you'd look up that source, right? You'd look up that source on your own with nobody in the room with you. You, God, and the book, right? And so, however that works together, the you that you are at that time, the God that's available to you because of who you are at the time, coalesces with what's on the page and how much you can absorb from it. That's it. That's how you learn it.
That's why I say it really has come, just God grants it to you and understand.
Exactly. 100%. That is how you get it.
Yeah.
That is how you get it.
And not from a teacher.
And so you got that. So you do get it from a teacher because now you looked that up. Now you're in a class where Rabbi Stern is explaining bug checking, right? And he says one sentence that has to do with what you just learned. Nobody else hears that sentence because
right.
It's not about bug checking.
Right.
Right? It's one sentence that unlocks the question that you had. Like, that's what that means. It totally is a gift. And that happens regularly as you're learning. That there'll be the one sentence here or the one Dvar Torah there or just a piece of it. That's exactly that thing that you were working on inside yourself. And it totally shifts your entire understanding. Now that you have that one piece, puts everything else into place. And now you're a different kli. Now you're a different utensil that can receive Torah differently. And so you will receive it differently. And the next time you look at something, it shifts into a different place. And then you're available to hear another one sentence that maybe that person didn't even mean to say. But you get it. And that's how it works. So in that sense, you do get it from a teacher. And then you have...
From God.
Right. Which comes from God. And then that gives you a specific question, which you could ask somebody a specific question. In private sometimes. And sometimes they'll be able to give you an answer. Sometimes they'll give you the source. But sometimes they'll have that conversation with you, but it is all God directed, depending on how you make yourself into somebody who can receive that from God. Okay, so next week we will get to the parts of the Mikdash. At least we got to that place. And that's much cleaner here. We'll go to that. And you get your gold stars for the homework if you do it. And if not, we'll do it together. Bezrat Hashem. Should we all be Zocha to get there?